Well, good afternoon. It's nice to be back, and it was nice to be gone. What can I say? I have to be honest. Greetings to those in Post Falls, also those on the Internet. It's been a nice opportunity to be able to attend a general conference in Ohio and to be gone a few extra days. I had a chance to go out early for some wilderness first aid classes that Mr. Lukey asked me to take to certify to teach at camp. And the rock climbing program on one of our sites is over an hour away from medical help. So they want a little extra training on the first aid. One thing I didn't get a chance to practice much, they were teaching us how to put back in dislocated joints. So I just thought, you know, if anybody here, you know, maybe pulls your arm out, just call me first. I need a little practice on that one. We had Larry Greider. They would put us through scenarios, and they would tell the person what to say, and sometimes they'd paint him up a little bit with where the wounds would be, and you'd have to kind of figure out what the damage was and then treat it. And he had hypothermia one time. Of course, it's 85 degrees out. We're a couple hundred miles north of Cincinnati where we took these classes. And so he's laying out there, and they painted his lips blue, and he's laying out the hypothermia. So we pulled out the ground pad and put him on the pad and pulled out the sleeping bag and stuffed him in the sleeping bag, and then we put stocking cap on his head, and we had a fleece. And then we wrapped him in a cover over around the whole thing to seal it. And, of course, then he was headed for a heat stroke. But that way we got to treat him on both sides, but it was so funny. After a while, you could just see him start to break out a little bit, and we had to start peeling off all the layers. But we had some excellent classes. But I said I didn't get much chance to practice on the dislocation. So let me know if there's something comes up. I'd like to help out. Maybe John, you know. No, nothing quite like that. There was eight of us that were there for the classes, joining another group that was already in place. And most of the men are camp directors and gentlemen that I've been friends with over the years, and they're a real pleasant group to be with. So I just have to say we enjoyed ourselves and learned at the same time. There are some rock climbing programs that are being added to a couple of camps next summer, and one camp in the east possibly will be started completely new, on a little bit different format. I don't want to make any announcements because I don't know what's been said and what hasn't. I'll just mention that in the course of being there, I had a few requests for some additional assistance next summer, and I simply didn't make a commitment. But I have to warn you all that there's some incredible opportunities if you happen to be a rock climber in the camp program at this time. So there will be some requests, I think, for me to assist next summer, but I've kind of deferred my options. I do pastor on the side, and I don't want to get too far away from my primary purpose here. Michelle came out Friday. I had gone out Monday, and we had a chance to go through the home office, which I had never seen except in pictures. Some of you have already been out there. I was very encouraged. It's nice, but it's not, in that sense, elegant. It's just nice, very functional, but seemed to be well sufficient for the type of task at hand, and I was just encouraged to see everybody there, to realize how many people we have from different nationalities and backgrounds that are working in the home office. I actually wrote that down on a list, and then I left it somewhere at home, so I can't, you know, go through person by person, but the experience and the flavor of those who are there is very, very broad. At the conference, 225 elders attended, 180 of the wives were there as well. The largest group by about 100, I think, that we've had at a conference, where everybody has come in that respect. We were all hooked up for Sabbath services, so those of us that were all together in that way were hearing the same thing. But it was like bigger than going to the feast for me. We go to Kelowna, and Kelowna usually has about 500 people. We had 766 in the hall. And then online, we had 133 congregations, which really is more than that, because we had a line come into Post Falls, but you were hooked up here. So, I mean, the extra hookups were not even counted. But there was 133 direct connections to congregations, and then 120 more Cybercast connections. So who knows how many people were online, but quite a few thousand were all at one place at one time. Aaron Dean, you couldn't see it, but he spoke about his red jacket that he wore on the plane when he was steward for Mr. Armstrong years ago. I've seen him before, and at one time they took it out for a test flight, and they called me, and I had a chance to run out, and we flew around as they tested it. I thought, we need to do this more. Great, Aaron, put on your jacket. I'll take a meal, please. But Aaron, what was amazing, if I think back, let's see, Michelle and I left Pasadena in 1985. Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, so it was previous to that time. But he put on that jacket, and if you've ever seen Aaron Dean, it absolutely fit like a glove. He has to be one of the few individuals who can actually put on a suit from 20 years ago and have it still fit. I can't even do that, and I really thought I would, but I'm probably 5 years out of my last set of suits, size-wise. But anyway, Aaron made a comment in his sermon, and we had a chance to have dinner with him and Michelle that evening, and so we had a chance to discuss it at length. But he made a comment. He says, if I could do anything in the church, you know, it's like you get one wish, and you could have anything you wanted with your one wish. And Aaron says, if I could do anything in the church, I would bring back a sense of urgency, a sense of urgency about Christ's return. Do you remember being on the gun lap? We were always on the gun lap. And every year was the same gun lap, and there would be one more year. The time came when, in some respects, in our minds and those in various respects who taught us as well began to mock that. And to claim that somehow that was perfect balance isn't my point. But I do think it was interesting that Aaron said, if I could give back one thing, it would be a sense of urgency back to the church. Maybe the gun lap was something we needed. Maybe at least in our minds, being zealous for the fact that Christ was going to return and striving to make the most of the time that we had was really in our best interest after all. And I have to ask myself, you know, where indeed has that specifically gone? I know when I have a goal, I narrow my focus and I begin to prepare very specifically. And when I have a deadline that I ask myself, what does it take to get to that deadline and accomplish the task at hand? And I begin to structure my life accordingly. And when I'm going to speak, I know that I have to prepare for that and walk up to it and then ask Gail to drive so I can finish. But I know that I approach that in a very specific way. I haven't had to speak in that sense for 2 weeks because Bob Dick spoke at the weekend for the ladies and then came down and I went to conference. I had to go back and figure out all over again how to speak. But in your mind, the minute the deadline is removed in this flesh, we tend to relax. And I think in some respects, as a church, we have relaxed. In some ways, spiritually, we have stepped back just a little bit. And Aaron recognized that and said, if wished, in some way, if he could, he would give that back to the church. I don't study as deeply when I'm not preparing to teach as I do when I am. It's just a natural process. I have to study more deeply when I prepare to teach. I don't run as many miles if I do not have a specific physical goal or deadline in mind. I run an easier course because Steve is trying to drag me out in the mountains again. I have had to reevaluate the mileage I run, the number of hills that are in that. I have to consciously seek out harder tasks to try to prepare. We do that spiritually. And when those deadlines are gone, we reduce the level of task that we challenge ourselves with and what we face. How do we maintain a sense of urgency in the church? At the conference, at the beginning of the conference every year, they do the international reports in the morning. The balloting issues are in the afternoon, and it's on a Sunday. And the various international areas rotate so that every 2 years you will hear all of the reports that are given at the conference time. Now, some of that material will be in United News. Much of that is, I brought 8 copies of the minutes that I put on the back table, and some of the information is in there as well. But invariably, when I hear the reports given, there's one specific thing that stands out. We are truly, truly blessed in this nation, and we are very specifically blessed by having a body of size in the church to assemble and meet with here in the United States as well. Even though our congregations are much smaller than they used to be, we are still far, far better off than so much of the rest of the world. If you just took this circuit, Post Falls, down here in Kennewick, there would be twice as many of us today on the Sabbath meeting than there is in all of Italy. All of Italy has half of simply the brethren that we have assembling together today on just this circuit. If we added again up, all of us, just on this one circuit, we would be larger than the British Isles. We would be a fifth as large as all of Canada. Now, I don't think in those terms oftentimes, but when I hear these individuals get up and begin to reflect on what it is that they live with and deal with on a day-by-day basis, 5 of these circuits is the entire Canadian national work that is being done in terms of the attendance that is in place up there. And it's more than the British Isles. It's more than Italy. It's twice. And many other of the international areas of the work. Our access to fellowship, our ability to contribute and serve each other, and to meet together, and to spiritually edify each other, is in that sense greater than much of the rest of the entire world. And yet we are small because we remember what it was like in many cases to be large. I don't know what the congregations were at one time down here. How many used to attend? A couple of hundred? And there was probably 400 or more that were in Spokane, and there was another 150 or whatever that was in Coeur d'Alene. I mean, we remember the great glory days. And yet still, these are great glory days if you compare them to most anywhere else around this world. David Baker was describing some of the circumstances and areas where he assists pastorally. And he mentioned the Philippines. The Philippines is an English-speaking nation, and so they use our literature just as it's produced. It doesn't have to be translated there. The most requested booklet in the Philippines. Think about that in your mind. What is it in the Philippines that they first of all wanted to read in our booklets? And the title of the booklet, he said, was Why Does God Allow Suffering? The first book they ordered. You see, we don't request that one first. We want to know about the future or prophecy. We want to know something exciting because, frankly, we are not suffering that much. Our bellies are full. Our needs are met. Emotionally, we have battles and struggles, and there are circumstances that we would specifically say, this is tough, but it's only tough on our scale. It's not tough on the scale of what most of the people overseas from us internationally in the church face on a day-by-day basis. It's simply tough because of what we are accustomed to. You know what the least requested booklet is in the Philippines? Managing your finances. Because they don't have finances to manage. They don't need that book in the same way. They need to know about suffering and why God allows it, and they don't have that much they need to manage. That's just not the way it is for us. We live our life the other way around. We want to know how to manage what we have and make something out of it. We want our homes to appreciate. We want our cars to be maintained and run well. We want our houses and properties to be nice and blessed, in that sense, beautiful and pleasant to us. Fine, that's good. That's what I want too. But again, when I sit and listen to the reports come in at conference or where they come in afterwards, if we are not able to go, it always brings me back to a little clearer, cleaner perspective in terms of just exactly what it's like for the average brethren in the church. Joe mentioned a couple of examples. There's a place in India where the people can't really afford to even request free literature because they don't have enough money to it's not free to them. It's a half a day or a day's wage to just request the literature. And there's places where indeed it costs a day's wage in the Philippines to even go to church. Well, you can't go to church if it costs a day's wage. That's more than your tithe for the feast for the whole year, just to go to your weekly Sabbath service. And yet, we jump in the car, we get on our in our vehicles, and Eileen jumps in her wheelchair, and we're here at church. And it's a great blessing. But again, it's always an adjustment for me to listen to the reports as they come in, and just to be reminded of what it's like in other places. In the United States, over this past year, the Good News distribution dropped because we renewed the waiting room program, and I know up in Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, we had over 1,000 subscriptions went out when the waiting rooms were put in, and basically those subscriptions dropped down to about 5% when they were renewed. They simply were there in numbers, but there wasn't an active response to those subscriptions at this time. And so when they peeled all of those off by non-renewals, it's going to now take some time to build that back up. Income for the last 12 months is up about 3%. Budget increase projected for next year, which was approved, is about 4%. They have looked at the increase over the last years and also their projections. And I'm frankly, 4% doesn't sound like much compared to the great big years of the church. But compared to the economy that we're facing in circumstance, it seems almost generous to me. But again, the expectation is that it will be met. Donor and co-worker income, when United Church of God started, was obviously zero. Right now it is 10% of the income of the church. Over the last year, both donor and co-worker income increased 24%. So some of the seed that is out there is indeed bearing fruit, and individuals are saying, let me help you. Let me lend my hand to this. I am a part of this as well. When United Church of God was established and we came together on Pentecost, many of us had held back tithes and offerings, not knowing indeed what to do with it or where to go. And so there was a huge offering all at one time as we all assembled back together and started over. And this pile of money came flowing in because it had been held in reserve in various respects. The first offering this year of the Days of Unleavened Bread is the first time in those years that that offering has been surpassed. But we have actually, by God's grace and mercy, grown and shown increase to the point where our offering now finally equals that initial offering way back then. I think the attendance at the Feast of Tabernacles worldwide last year was probably 19,000. Again, God has shown great blessing in many, many ways. Some of those numbers are very encouraging. But I think we still have to ask ourselves, in the course of the growth and the opportunity that we see, do we really have a sense of urgency? Is just moving in a positive direction good enough? Or are we urgent in our preparation for the return of Jesus Christ? Prior to the Days of Unleavened Bread this year, I asked various people, and I asked some of you in discussion, this was presented, and I asked what your feelings were on it. But prior to those Days of Unleavened Bread, I asked, what was the most fundamental weakness of the United Church of God? What core issue was it that probably we needed to address the most? And the answer came back to me in various ways. And I even asked some people who do not attend with the United Church of God, or people who didn't used to attend, that would look at us from the outside. And you know what the answer most commonly came back? The answer came back is that we are self-satisfied. We have a pastoral structure. We have local congregations. We have a certain measure of consistent growth. We have the blessing and ability to affiliate and fellowship and be together, and that there is a certain satisfaction, there is a certain comfort level in being, maybe as we would perceive at times, the biggest kid on the block. And that was the way that perception was brought back and addressed to me. There are many blessings that we have received. Our lives are busy. We travel to the feast and assemble. Income and attendance is up. And I have to ask, is that good enough. Is that what God has called us to do? Why would Aaron get up from his perspective long term of the church, from growing up in the church, from seeing it under the glory days, as we've sometimes portrayed, and looking now, and he serves diligently on the council, self-employed, sacrifices to be there. Why would Aaron say, if I could do anything, I would give the church back a sense of urgency? After the regional reports, there was a tribute to the elders and wives who have died since 1995. There's a book there, and I gave one to Joe as I came in today, and so you can look at his and see who was listed there. But 28 husbands and wives who have served ministerially have died since 1995, and they missed one person that they'll have to put into next year's presentation. But they actually collected material on some of those individuals and then wrote an epitaph, so to speak, in a book and in a slideshow for all of us to be reminded of and to see. Some of the individuals on that list I knew fairly personally, Mr. White, Mr. Valden White up in Spokane, Mrs. Wilberg, Gay Berg, again, a fairly personal friend, Mr. Waterhouse. I knew him not intimately, but I did spend a fair amount of time with him as he would come and go from Pasadena at that time. There were individuals that I saw in various ways in personal parts of their lives. There were other individuals on the presentation of those 28 who I knew less personally, and some whom I did not even know at all. And on the very back of the brochure, there's a picture. And again, if you have a chance, ask Joe to look at the back. There's a picture of Mr. Waterhouse and a member of the church. And Mr. Waterhouse is laughing just wide open, and he has his hand on the other person. The other person is just laughing back. And you look at the picture, and you just see this joyfulness and this excitement in the picture that is almost contagious when you see the shot. You know, I have never, ever seen Mr. Waterhouse down or depressed. Now, I don't assume that didn't ever exist in his life. But I do know about his life and the circumstances of his life and what he gave up and what he desired. And I remember at lunch sitting with him one time, because I looked at Mr. Waterhouse's life, frankly, as a bit of a burden. Single, perpetually, by choice, traveling around the world without a home. His car was his office. No particular possessions or homestead or roots. Always traveling for all of his life, living in a motel room or in a bedroom of a member's home. And I asked him one time at lunch, and I asked him what kind of a burden or sacrifice that was, how hard it was for him to do those kinds of things and to live that kind of life. And you know what he said? He says, it's not a burden. It's a blessing. He actually looked at me surprised, like I would ask him about this burden that he carried, which to me was, for the rest of your life, just travel around the globe and live in a motel room and speak every day and not have any place to really root yourself or relax in that same way. And he looked at me and his eyes kind of lit up and he says, it's what God gave me to do. It is an opportunity. And I couldn't hardly forget that. So I look at the picture in the back and here's Mr. Waterhouse laughing and a member laughing. And there was an incredible joy there at an opportunity of service that indeed most of us would consider to be a great weight and a burden to have to fulfill in that specific way. That was a gift God gave to him. On the brochure, there's also a picture of Mr. and Mrs. Berg. If you've ever been in their home, and probably most of you wouldn't have had that opportunity, but since I go to camp every year and we have services there, I'm in their home on a regular basis from year to year. And on top of their piano has always been a picture of Mr. and Mrs. Berg with a coiled rope around their shoulders, both of them, in their older years, standing on a rock out in the wilderness, like as if they're just on an expedition out to climb whatever lay in their path. And I have always loved that picture more than anything else in their home. And that picture was included in the brochure as well. What an incredible picture. Mrs. Berg was a joy. She was a loving, kind, and diligent person. And when she died, it wasn't just a loss to Mr. Berg, it was a loss to the church and to the churches and the congregations where they had served. And so I began to look at some of these individuals who lived their life, effectively had an epitaph written day by day. And I want to share just two of those with you that come out of the book. One was Tolu Hautangana. Met him a couple of times. He would be mentioned, anytime you wanted to talk about somebody with a good attitude, you'd mention Mr. Hautangana, because he was in Tonga. And if some of you went there for the feast over years, and a few have possibly, you would have met him. But it says, let me just read you a little bit of his life and his focus. A lifetime resident of the Kingdom of Tonga, isolated in the vastness of the South Pacific Ocean, Tolu Hautangana died October 22, 2002, on his 50th wedding anniversary. Mentions his wife, Sila, and the sons, four sons and four daughters who remain. His life began January 9, 1929, as one of six children. After graduating from high school, he found employment in the Ministry of Agriculture, where he held various positions and responsibilities until his entire retirement in 1981. His calling began in 1960 when, as he was reading a Reader's Digest magazine, he saw a Plain Truth magazine advertisement. He was 31 years old and a lay preacher in the Methodist Church. And he said, "I began to construct my sermons from the articles in the Plain Truth." You can imagine that that wouldn't have lasted very long. But he says he preached those from the pulpit whenever he was given an assignment. He said, "People were interested in my sermons. Friends borrowed my copy of the Plain Truth, and some subscribed to the magazine, and that is how the truth of God spread in the island of Tonga. One man got the magazine, began to teach, and people who knew him and respected him and looked to him began to listen and respond as well." He goes on to describe how he began to keep the Sabbath, and when he was baptized, and he kept his first Feast of Tabernacles. He says, "When he returned from the feast, Tolu set aside 1 acre of his land, dedicated it to God, and began the construction of a church building. His first feast, and he came home, and this is the church, him and his wife, and he dedicated part of his property and began to build a building where the church could meet." Isn't it amazing that the church eventually had a congregation that could fill it and sit there and participate in Sabbath services with him? Because he began, in that sense, obviously by God's instruction, it would seem, to build. As he wrote in his diary regarding the building's construction, "I started when I got back from work at 5:30 p.m., and I worked until 1 a.m. in the morning, Monday through Thursday, every week. I have at times worked until 3 a.m. trying to finish this building for the Feast of Tabernacles. A few of the church members helped me whenever they had time. It was very unfortunate that we could not do any work on Sunday because it was restricted by the law. In 1968, 31 brethren observed their first Feast of Tabernacles in Tonga in the new building that still stands on the church property. In 1969, Tolu moved his family dwelling to the land adjacent to church building. He was ordained a deacon in 72, an elder in 77. That's interesting. He started building the church back in the 60s. He didn't wait until he was recognized in some capacity. He just began to build. In 81, he retired and served the church full-time. Began a radio broadcast in 79, a TV program in 84. And it just goes on to say he served faithfully through the years, and he passed the hat on to an elder prior to his death. Tolu was bedridden for the last few months of his life, experiencing great difficulty in breathing due to congestion in his lungs. He died October 22, 2002, having played an important role in bringing the truth to the brethren God called in the warm and friendly Kingdom of Tonga. What an epitaph to have written in your name by those who watched you, listened to you, learned from you, and a church congregation that God raised up basically through his own hands. There was another one in there, Charles Hansen, and I want to read part of that to you. Reads a little differently. At the age of 13, Toy hit him in the eye accidentally, and he lost sight in both of his eyes. And it goes on to describe how he graduated from Minnesota Braille and Sight Saving School, attended North Dakota State University, attended and graduated from Palmer College of Chiropractic. And he was building his business in chiropractic when he understood and was called into the church. And at that time, there were certain medical things, frankly, that the church simply just didn't do. Joe was a pharmacist, and then the next winter, Joe was running a ski lift up in the mountains, and he was a pharmacist. Now, Joe's a pharmacist again, but there was a period of time when those things simply weren't available to him. Charles Hansen was trained in a specific area, and he says he walked away from it when he became aware of the church's position on divine healing back at that time. He simply walked away, changed careers, became a piano tuner, a tribute to his character, determination, and faith. Not a tribute to our knowledge and understanding, necessarily, a tribute to his character, determination, and faith. If you have been wronged, if your life has not been exactly fair, if circumstances in your life have not been ideal, that is not necessarily spiritual disaster. That might be indeed a step up to spiritual focus. Not that we would wish injury to ourselves, but still, character needs to be separated from our circumstances in which we live. Charlie felt God blessed him in this endeavor, and from the first day he started his new career, he always had at least one piano to tune every single day. Talks about his wife, Mavis, and how much she helped him, driving him back and forth, reading to him, encouraging him. Ordained a deacon in 1970 and elder in 1988. Charlie had a Braille book that took up about 5 or 6 feet on the bookshelf, a Bible. How would you like to have a Bible that was 6 feet long on the bookshelf in order to read your Bible? He had read them so often, he couldn't read the dots any longer. He had worn dots off of his Braille Bible in simply reading it there with his hands. He was an exceptional student of the Scripture, was noted for his outstanding memory, sharp wit, and sense of humor. Blind since a child, have to read a 6-foot-long Bible, lost his career field that he had trained for and had to start all over, wife needing to drive him around and read to him, and he was known for his sharp wit and sense of humor. His messages were prepared in Braille, were always organized and thought-provoking. Charlie was diagnosed with cancer in October of 1998, died 3.5 weeks later. He was such a fine example, and during his final trial without complaint, he fought to live but was willing to accept death. The first week after his diagnosis, he called many friends, telling them of his cancer and thanking them for the many ways they had helped him throughout his life. First thing he did was stop and thank everybody for the many blessings that he had received. You know, I think back, and I had a chance to talk to Herb Teigen this conference, and his wife Ann died last summer. And I used the example in a sermon that when she was dying and he asked God simply to allow her to live long enough for the children to come in. And so here's a man, his wife's sick, dying. God lets her die and he thanks God for his tender mercies and allowing her to live so that the family could assemble and see her before she died. And I reminded him of that and what an inspiration it was to me this trip. And you could see it was sobering to him to go back and reflect, but it was such an encouragement to me that he was as strong as he was. The afternoon before he died, his granddaughter crawled up on his lap, gave him a big hug. Charlie smiled broadly and said with a loud voice, "I am at peace. I am at great peace." Those were his final words. Seeing him smile and hearing him say those words gave his wife, his family, and his friends great peace as well. To die like that before God with the trial and test of this life and say, "I am at peace, I am at great peace," gave his family comfort as well. Brethren, we're writing our epitaphs every day, every struggle, every success. We are writing those words down that someday our friends will speak in some respect for us. Before Paul died, he wrote what I would attribute in some respects to that in 2 Timothy 4 and verse number 6. You know, you could change this. Paul wrote it. God recorded it as Scripture. But you could turn this around as if we were speaking for him, as an epitaph would be, and you could read it this way. "For he is already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of his departure is at hand. He has fought the good fight. He has finished the race. He has kept the faith. And finally, there is laid up for him the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to him on that day, and not to him only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. You could write it the other way, and it would be as if you and I then went back, if we had such knowledge, and gave record of his diligence and the way that he lived his life and the purpose that was in there. Where, brethren, is our sense of urgency? Where is our ability to stand up under trial or duress and rejoice before God? We need that desperately. We need to help each other with it. When Mr. Hansen died there, I think it was Hansen again. Yes, Mr. Hansen died. The fact that he could say, yes, I am at peace, my life was enough, helped his family to be able to be at peace as well. It was an important process. It was an important thing to be able to say. Clyde Kylo gave the closing remarks. And I walked up to Clyde afterwards as the meeting closed down and we walked out the door. And I told him that what he had just said to me was as profound as anything that I had recently heard addressed in the church. A few minutes' comments, some of which, again, is in the notes. And I want to share a part of that with you. It impacted me in a significant way. He spoke of fratricide. Think what fratricide is. What's fraternity? Fraternity is brotherhood. Fratricide is when you kill your brothers and your sisters. Now, fratricide isn't, I'm not using it in just some generic way. I'm using it in the way that it technically applies. Fratricide is the technical term for friendly fire during wartime. Friendly fire. We hear about that because of the war in Iraq and then Gulf War I and Afghanistan. We hear about it when a pilot drops a bomb on our own people. We hear about it when somebody gets shot or attacked by our own people, or when a tank blows up, or somebody gets on the wrong side of the firefight and gets killed or injured. We hear about it, and we hear about it loud and clear. Fratricide is friendly, as they call it, which is obviously not friendly at all, but friendly fire during wartime. You know what the level of injury and death has been in, say, I haven't seen all of the statistics from the recent Gulf War, but Gulf War I? How many of the casualties in Gulf War I by percentage were from friendly fire? 17%. 17% of the casualties were from friendly fire. Now, I understand that the total casualties in that war were light on our side. There was 146 dead, and there was 480 wounded. So in terms of scale, we're not talking thousands here, but we are talking percentage. In terms of the tanks and the armored vehicles that were damaged, do you know how many of them were damaged by friendly fire? 77%. Again, not huge numbers, but huge percentages. In one case, because our equipment and our training is meant to pick up on enemy fire, the Iraqis were firing against a tank or a series of tanks with rocket launchers. The rocket launchers were hitting the tanks and lighting up, and to the rest of the tanks that looked like enemy fire as it came off of the explosion on the tank itself, and in the heat of battle, as they call the fog of war, they literally turned on their own tanks to shoot where those explosions were taking place and took out our own vehicles in the fog of war. I thought that was rather dramatic and remarkable that 77% of the damage was from ourselves. World War I through Korea, it was a normal circumstance that anywhere between about 1.5% and 3% of all casualties were from friendly fire. The rate, obviously, in Desert Storm, because the numbers were so much smaller, but the circumstances a little different, was actually 17%. There's one account I read about in World War II where 410 of the American troops were lost in a single engagement because we mistook the troop planes as enemy bombers, and we shot down our own men in the planes. They simply didn't know any better at that time. No matter how you look at it, friendly fire is not friendly at all. What Clyde did was he drew a connection between the injury and the damage from friendly fire and that which has sometimes happened within the church. How many of you, indeed, have been hurt by friendly fire? How many of you have hurt someone else by friendly fire in the church? You see, that's where the pain truly becomes bitter at times, and indeed very, very enduring. When we're attacked by an enemy, we almost expect that. That's not something to us that is particularly unusual. It's not any fun, but then again, it's not a shock, and we deal with it. But when we are attacked by a family member or a friend, it cuts very, very personal and deep. Notice Psalm 55. Many of the messages this year were dealing with the ministry in terms of their ability to counsel and advise, when to refer, how to work together as a family of the ministry as well, how to serve. It's Psalm 55. Notice the description here of the pain and the injury that is building. Give ear to my prayer, O God, and do not hide yourself from my supplication. Attend to me and hear me. I am restless in my complaint and moan noisily because of the voice of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked. When you read on, you'll begin to get a little better description of who he's talking about in terms of who has become the enemy and who has appeared in that sense of the role of the wicked. For they bring down trouble upon me, and in wrath they hate me. My heart is severely pained within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fearfulness and trembling have come upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me. And I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then I would fly away and be at rest. Indeed, I would wander far off and remain in the wilderness. I would hasten my escape from the windy storm and tempest. So he describes wanting to just get out of there, just to hide, to run, to escape, to somehow be protected. And yet, go up to verse number 12, and you begin to see who it is that he's referring to. He says, for it was not an enemy who reproached me, then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me who has magnified himself against me, then I could hide from him. You see, we hide from our enemies. We put a barrier up and we keep them at distance. But our family and our friends and those whom we love are in close to us at our side. But it was you, a man my equal, my companion and my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked to the house of God in the throng. He's basically saying it was, well, as we would describe, what we were in church together. We went to the feast together. We camped in Big Sandy and we barbecued together. And we traveled and I fixed your car and you helped me with the trailer. And we traveled and we rejoiced before God. It is you who has turned your hand against me. It is you who has wounded me in this way. Again, Clyde asked, how many of us have been wounded in this way? And then he said, well, how many of us have wounded each other in this way? If I could read you, and that's where it really struck home to me. Friendly fire in the church. Under his concluding remarks, he says, the basics of combat have always been the same. Where am I? Where is my buddy? Where is the enemy? Friendship is keeping track of each other, and I would have to say spirituality is knowing, indeed, who is the enemy and who is the friend. There is a lot in the Bible about friendly fire in the spiritual sense. There are two tendencies when fired on by a friend. Not an enemy, a friend. One is to get discouraged and the other is to fire back. You ever fire back? Someone fires at you and you just fire it right back. In fact, you fire back with a bigger gun just to make sure that you take them out and that it doesn't happen again. Some are wounded right now, Mr. Kyler said. How many times have we wounded others? Wounded people can't fight very effectively. Wounded people are not very zealous. Wounded people don't have a sense of urgency for the work. They have a sense of urgency to get well. And so they focus on their injury instead of the outward focus on what it is that God has called us externally then to do. Christ is sensitive to friendly fire. Wounded elders minimize our effectiveness. Again, speaking to a crowd of elders, because he says Christ is sensitive to friendly fire because he probably has experienced it the most. When we find out that we have wounded others, our first reaction almost always is, I didn't mean to, but that doesn't make it hurt any less. We need to go to our brother, we need to repent, and we also need to forgive. Ephesians 4, verses 2 and 3 gives us some high-tech tools that we need to avoid friendly fire. With all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. In the bond of peace. I want to go to Matthew 18. I addressed Matthew 18 some time back. I don't remember just exactly how far, so I'm going to focus more on the beginning of the chapter and a little less on the latter part of it. But Matthew 18 is an entire chapter about, one, not causing offense, two, not being offended, and then three, indeed, to try to find a way to reconcile and restore, and above all, in the end, to be forgiving so that that process can be contained, so that the injuries are minimized, and so that no, indeed, friendly fire incidents in addition need to occur. Matthew 18, verse 1. At that time the disciples came to Jesus saying, who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus called a little child to him and set him in the midst. He said, assuredly I say to you, unless you're converted, become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. So the first thing that's addressed is to, first of all, that we humble ourselves. A person who has humbled himself is not going to be quick to fire at and shoot and wound and injure someone else. Then it goes on in verse number 6. It says, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it'd be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depths of the sea. Why is it so critical that the little ones not be offended? Think about a child. What does a child do? Well, a child plays a lot. They play work. They play church. What point in our life is work no longer play and becomes an obligation and a duty? And by extension, at what point in our life is church no longer exciting and rewarding and meaningful and pleasant and becomes indeed, to some level, an obligation and a duty? I have to get up. We have to get going. We have to get to church. At what point does part of our spiritual focus become an obligation and a duty? And Christ says, don't offend the little ones. Because for them, life is still opportunity. Life is still open and exciting. Don't you dare make them believe that life is going to be a burden and an obligation and a debt that you will pay until you die. Mr. Hansen, I am at peace. I'm at great peace. It was encouraging to me to see examples of people like Mr. Hansen, Mr. Waterhouse, that when they died, people could literally say, you know, they indeed were an encouragement to us all. Not perfect, but an encouragement to us all. Sacrificed on our behalf in many ways. Woe to the world because of offenses. Offenses must come, but woe to the man by whom the offense comes. So when you go through Matthew 18, you see a very heavy focus on, one, not offending someone else. Two, not being offended personally. If your hand or foot caused you to sin, cut it off, cast it away. Don't let something stand in your own way of maintaining your focus, of staying positive and focused on God and doing His will. And then it talks about going after those who are lost and to try to help and encourage those, to contribute to them in some way. Then it talks the part we usually focus on, going to your brother, verse 15. It's still about reconciliation. It's not so much about confrontation. It is about trying to restore. And then if need be, the only insulation you have is to forgive, then do that as well. It is an incredible chapter in that way. Look at 1 Corinthians 8. Verse number 10, meat offered to idols. And in the context of the offering to idols and the sitting in the idol's temple, and it says, if anyone, verse 10, sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak, like a child, be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? Because of your knowledge shall this weak brother perish for whom Christ died. And notice verse 12. When you thus sin against the brethren, when you by friendly fire cause injury or damage in some way, when we thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, we sin against Christ. Christ said, when we do good, we do it unto Christ. And when we do wrong, the impact is the same. We are our brother's keeper. Our focus, though, brethren, cannot simply be on trying not to offend. Our focus must also be on doing that which is needful and that which is right. We need to have, what does a child have? A child has, by definition, almost first love. First love. Revelation 2. Sometimes when we look at Revelation 2 and 3, I think we have a tendency to turn toward Philadelphia, maybe even toward Laodicea. We read those that we look at in terms of a more of a focus at the end prior to Christ's return, and yet it says, to he who has an ear, let him hear. These messages are all for each of us. But look at Revelation 2 and verse number 1. Referencing the church of Ephesus, the first of the eras of the church, and a message that describes the love of those who went first. These things says he who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks in the midst of seven golden lampstands. I know your works, your labor, and your patience. So they were working, they were diligent in that respect, and they continued on. They could not bear those who are evil. Pretty good description so far. And you have tested those who say they are apostles and are not and have found them liars. And I would say we have probably done exactly that as well. And you have persevered and have patience. And we continue on. We have done that. And have labored for my name's sake and have not become weary. Nevertheless, I have this against you, that you have left your first love. You have still lost your zeal. Your first love and desire, do we remember walking in the door to church? Or do we remember growing up to the point where that light bulb finally went off inside us in a very personal way? And there was a desire to commit, there was a desire to fulfill that, there was a willingness to tithe and to give an offering, expecting God's blessing. We had expectation and hope for our marriage, our relationships, our families, our opportunity. The feast was exciting. The sacrifice of going was worth it all because we had our first love. So here are people that are described as laboring, working, being patient, not putting up with apostasy or heresy, and going on, and yet still without their first love. They're simply continuing on. As Aaron said, I wish I could give to the church a sense of urgency. Brethren, it is not enough to simply hold on. It's not enough to just maintain. We show up for church. We're loved to show up for church. We're happy to be here. But are we zealous? Or are we just on an ongoing incremental gain because we're holding on? It is not enough to just hold on. Brethren, we need a sense of urgency. We need an epitaph that's being written for us that says, yes, he or she was kind, and he or she was willing, but he or she also went beyond that and was helpful and inspiring and diligent in their service to me. And I miss them. I miss them because they contributed to my life in a very specific way. Children play at the work parts of life that you and I sometimes endure as an obligation, and at some point in their life, they stop playing and they start obligating themselves at times as if it becomes a burden, as it is sometimes to the rest of us. And God says, I want you to go back. I want you to go back to like the child and to be excited to do these things and to look at them as opportunities and blessings. And when you give that offering and when you serve that person and when you care for that one who is sick, I want you to understand that it is my Spirit working in you. Brethren, we need indeed to have a sense of urgency in our Christian service and sacrifice before God. We're a family. We're in it together. There is no room for friendly fire. The damage to friendly fire in oftentimes is what? If you get shot at by the enemy, you expected that. When you get shot at by a friend, you often will become discouraged. And many of God's people, frankly, at one level or another, have become discouraged. Some went home and sat by themselves. Some pulled back and became very protective. Some simply participate at a level as long as it doesn't require too much inclusion. And there are those, like children, who simply jump and run out and are there in the midst. God says, I'd like to have you like a child. Zealous, excited, gleeful of our opportunities, and not so much focused on the fact that there could indeed be hard times ahead. We will certainly never ignore that. But how much more do we need to recognize, indeed, the zeal, the blessing, and the mercy that comes by God's presence, brethren? We need a sense of urgency.